Great. Well, everyone, our vice chair, Mr. Mark Steinman, is going to facilitate this meeting. This is Tom Sparrow speaking. So, Mark, take it away.
Great. Thank you very much, Tom. Welcome, everybody, to the Storytelling and Organization Special Interest Group of the National Storytelling Network. This is our June Storytelling Lab, and I got to tell you, I am thoroughly excited to introduce to you Mr. Tony Miola, who, as I know that you've seen part of his bio, and if you've seen some of the messages that Tom and the organization was sending out, you already know some things. But for the record, Tony Miola is a highly experienced and current C-suite executive, and Tony is the current U.S. Consumer Operations Executive for Bank of America, an organization that maybe one or two of you have heard of.
Tony, I have a question. Is someone talking?
Oh, yes, somebody is talking now.
This is Judith Kolva from Fort Lauderdale. I can't hear a word.
I
can hear you just fine.
You can hear me, Tom.
I can hear you, Tom.
Okay.
Judith, can you hear me better now?
I can. Now you're perfect.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Well, so as I was sharing, Tony Miola is an experienced and current C-suite executive with Bank of America, and he has extensive experience with other Fortune 100 organizations from all across the nation. He's an awesome leader. He has a great leadership style, and his use of story is one of the things that has most engaged me, and I'll share a little bit more in a minute. But he's influenced thousands of employees across a number of different organizations, some that, well, you may have heard of, organizations like Citigroup or PNC Mortgage, New Century, B of A, Washington Mutual, and he was also CEO position at Saxon Mortgage, which is a Morgan Stanley company. But the thing that you may also be interested in is that he's an author of a book called 90 Days to Success as a Manager. And for me personally, I've had the chance to work with Tony for quite a number of years. And beyond the fact that he's a strong mentor to me and certainly to others, he's definitely one of those leaders that you jump ship to follow just because he's that kind of a leader. And he's got a great sense of humor, but he's also a very firm and fair and visionary leader. And if you've ever read the book by Laurie Silverman called Wake Me Up When the Data's Over, you may have read it in that book a paragraph around storytelling pioneers. And at one point in time, Laurie had interviewed me, and I had said that, you know, there were certain leaders that I really noticed made a difference. And while Tony wasn't named by name in that chapter, certainly Tony was the person that I was talking about. And it's my pleasure to introduce you to Tony Miola, and I know that you'll look for, through this conversation, a better understanding of how, as an executive leader in iconic organizations, that he's leveraged story to influence and lead other organizations. So, Tony, I don't know if you want to say a word or two before we get into the conversation, but I'm so excited and grateful for the time that you're sharing with us. Tony?
Hey, thanks, Mark. I appreciate it. I do have a couple of comments, I think, to set context, and then maybe we would be able to do some Q&A. I think that would be a good use of our time. First of all, it's a honor and a privilege to be here today and to participate in storytelling in organizations. And for me, it's a critical part of leadership. And anytime I could get a chance to share critical observations in leadership that I have seen over the course of my career and actually been fortunate enough to be mentored and adopt and actually successful in, it even just makes it that much sweeter for us. I thought I'd give you a little bit of my view of storytelling, and then we could perhaps open it up to some dialogue.
That'd be terrific.
You know, I think to begin with, storytelling has been long an integral part of society. I mean, it's shaped, I think, lives through, all throughout history of humanity, right? When our parents and their parents before them wanted to teach us a lesson or make a point to us or a lasting impression on our behavior, they didn't have us read a policy and procedure manual, and they didn't have us, you know, go to computer-based training or a self-directed course, or give us an incentive plan. Perhaps some did, but most didn't. But rather, what did they do? They told us a story, and it's so powerful, the storytelling as a medium, that most of us, if we think about our value system, it was created and influenced vis-a-vis storytelling. I mean, Pinocchio taught me how to tell the truth, right? The tortoise taught us all that focus and relentless pursuit of the finish line matters more than speed. The three little pigs always taught us about the importance of getting up early and stringing a strong foundation and making the right choices. And one of my favorites is the little ant that taught us about hopes and goals at the expense of a rubber tree plant. So throughout our lives, right, we're conditioned as humans to learn through storytelling. So it only follows that storytelling then becomes a really powerful and important communication tool in the world of leadership, because it's how people have been conditioned to be led for years. So I think it's important for us to kind of reflect on that, because the value system that we all have is probably the most important thing that we do have. And where you think of its sources, stories, it really becomes how each one of us kind of became us to begin with. And the reason I emphasize that is, as a lead-in comment, is it puts in context the real importance of the storytelling organization and the whole SIO concept and what we can learn as leaders and what we value as leaders. Now, you know, I know, and I know you know, the value of that. That's why you're in this group. But I think it's essential for the storyteller to understand the goal and why it works the way it works, so that you really understand the value of it and the importance of it as you become a greater and greater storyteller and a leader. And that really brings me to a story that I wanted to share with you. And the story I want to share with you is one that I use all the time in turnarounds and in setting goals with my organization throughout my leadership career. And that story, really, I've titled, "What Are You Playing For?" And it's really a story about when I was growing up, I was in a spelling bee contest in seventh grade. And that was eons ago, but I still remember it. And a spelling bee, probably some of you on the call aren't familiar with that because we have autocorrect today. But there was a time when you really had to know the words and you really had to spell them yourself. And in order to prepare you for that, they used to have contests as to which kid could spell the most words. And in seventh grade, I entered that contest, as I always have in the school. And it so happened that year that I was one of the final four. So there were four people left, and the championship round was to be the next day. And everybody was pretty excited. And to add a little bit more edge to it, there were three girls and one boy. So I was representing the male population of the entire school for its dignity. And the females obviously always were smarter, and they had three recipients ready to go after against me. So that night I went home, as I always did, and I went up to my room and I studied my spelling words. And there was a point in time where I felt ready to go, had the words down pretty much, you know, ready to compete. And I decided I was done studying, and I closed my spelling book. And I did what most, you know, seventh grade, you know, little boys do, is I went to play one of my sports games. And I was in the middle of playing a complicated baseball game. Actually, the name of it was Strat-O-Matic. You could look it up on the internet. It existed. But it was a really cool game before the days of actually, you know, all of the games the kids have today where they actually watch the guys hit the home runs, et cetera. You had to imagine this stuff as you went. But I enjoyed the game, and I was playing it. And about 15 minutes into it, there was a knock on the door, the bedroom door, and I opened the door, and there stood my mom. My mom was every bit of 4'8". She was an Italian Napoleon who struck fear into everyone she met. And her kids were no exception to that. And she stood there in the doorway, and she said, "What are you doing?" And, of course, I knew never to lie to my mom, so I said, "Hey, I'm playing Strat-O-Matic baseball." And she said, "Hey, you know, you got a spelling bee tomorrow. You should be studying." And I said to her, "Hey, you know, here's the book. Ask me any word. You go to any word in that book. I'm in. I got it. It's in control, Mom. Don't worry about it." She never opened the book. She just kind of flipped it on the bed. And she looked at me and she said to me, "Listen," she said, "we live in Newark, New Jersey. And there's no way for you to get out of Newark, New Jersey unless you get a college degree. And the only way you're going to get a college degree is to get a scholarship, because we really can't afford to send you to college. And the only way you're going to get a scholarship is if you're better than everyone else academically. And the only way you're going to be better than everyone else academically is you're going to win that spelling bee tomorrow. So put away the baseball game and study your words." The next day, 4 kids showed up to that spelling bee. 3 were playing for a Jolly Rancher and a certificate. 1 was playing for a full scholarship academic ride to Rutgers University. Who do you think won that spelling bee? It's a matter of focus. And what are you playing for? The story of how I won my spelling bee really elevates the game for my people. When we sit down at a goal-setting meeting, when we sit down at a project meeting, we now ask ourselves, what are we playing for here? Because if you're delivering technology because of a deadline that you have in 2 weeks, you begin to think about that technology delivery differently. You say to yourself, what I'm playing for here is 2 weeks from now I have to be done. So if I de-scope, if I take out things, if I cut corners, take a little bit more risk, I could get there. But if you're playing for Bank of America's reputation on their mobile platform, you're not cutting anything. You're not de-scoping anything. You're playing at a completely different level of delivery than the Chases and the Wells and the other folks that play for that same mobile platform delivery. That's really the lesson that we have locked onto here organizationally in my organization and actually others around me on goals. The key question for us as an organization is, what are we playing for? Because that sets the tone of the resource allocation, that sets the tone of the intensity, and it all comes back to sort of where I learned that lesson in that small spelling bee. While I was studying those words, all of a sudden, it wasn't to win that contest, but it was about me and it was about my life. And that made those words stick a lot better in my head, I will tell you that, than if I just played for the Jolly Rancher and the certificate. So the thing really is, a good storyteller really does 2 things, right? First, they could find the story in everyday life. And then the second thing they could do is relate the topic. And that's why in storytelling you hear a lot of stories relative to sports or a common experience, because people have to relate to it. And more nowadays, folks relate to sports because we're all playing sports regardless of gender or age. And that's something people relate to. You're also looking for a common experience in storytelling. So again, people could relate to it. Because if you don't have that common experience, you're losing a portion of the audience that can't relate to whatever experience you're talking about. I rarely will use a sports analogy in an audience where I doubt that all of them haven't played some level of sport in their life. So when I'm talking to a group that is in my age category, so let's call it between, 40 and 60, then, I'm probably going to use common experience. When I'm talking to a younger group, I'm going to probably lean to the sports analogy. If it's something that's in the news that's relevant, a Super Bowl, something everybody's talking to, then I'm going to use that analogy because people can relate to it. But the 2 things I would tell you, find the story in everyday life. If you're looking, they're there. But you've got to be aware of a story that you're thinking about. For years, I was looking for a great story about operationalizing a brand. Because one of the things that I do in leading consumer operations at Bank of America, my job is to operationalize our brand commitment out to the marketplace. And every place I would go, whether it be the grocery store, whether it be on vacation, I would be looking for how that brand is present in the operating or in the retail environment that I was in. My wife used to say to me, you don't run the grocery store. Will you stop talking to the grocery manager about how he gets his people motivated? Will you just buy the cereal and leave? I look for the story. So in looking for the story about an operational brand a couple of years ago, I wandered into a Krispy Kreme donut shop. Now, I don't know if you know what that is, and I don't know if you've ever been to a Krispy Kreme donut shop, but I will tell you this. If you have that opportunity, even if you do not like donuts, you need to go into a Krispy Kreme shop and see how they've operationalized their brand. Now, they've had, as a company, they've had their ups and downs like other companies, but one of the things that they've been consistent about since they first came on the scene is the way their stores are run and how they operationalize that brand. Now, I'll give you a quick soundbite of that. The first time I came across Krispy Kreme, I really wasn't thinking about operationalizing the brand. I was just wanted a cup of coffee. And as I was driving down a street in a town that I was visiting in Texas for business, I was looking for any coffee shop that I could find. I saw Krispy Kreme on a corner. I went into the Krispy Kreme to buy a cup of coffee. There was a very long line. If you ever go into one of these things, it's like a donut factory live, right? Everybody in there is making donuts. They're behind a glass wall, and you get to see them making the donuts. There's a cash register and a long island in front of that factory of donuts where people buy donuts and transact to get coffee, etc. And there was a fairly long line, I would say 8 to 10 deep, of folks waiting for their turn, to which I got on. As I was on that line, I was watching them flipping donuts, icing donuts, putting donuts in the oven, taking donuts out of the oven, and I became immersed in the donut making process. As I was looking at that, all in the span of 2.5 minutes, a woman came up to me and tapped me on the shoulder. She had a tray of donut pieces, and she said, would you like a donut? And I said, sure. So I grabbed a donut, and I grabbed, you know, a napkin. I started to test out their donuts, which are really good. But as I was sitting there, another kid came up to me and tapped me on the shoulder, and he said to me, would you like a cup of coffee? I said, sure, I take it black. And now I'm sitting there eating my donut and coffee in line for a cup of coffee. As the line started to progress and I ate more donuts and drank more coffee, I really began to get nervous because I said, what am I going to do when I get to the front of this line? I've already had breakfast that I came in for. I haven't even paid anybody yet. When I got up to the counter, the person behind the counter asked me a question. And the question they asked me was this, sir, how many dozen would you like? I looked and I said, two. And I went in for a cup of coffee, and I walked out with 24 donuts and no cup of coffee. But the experience of the donut was apparent to me in the operating environment that I was in, operationalizing that brand, that Krispy Kreme. It's fun. It's light. It's ready to go. It's hot. It's a statement of donuts. And I bought the 24 donuts into the site that I was visiting, and they thought I was a hero for bringing them donuts, and I could not tell them the story because at that point in time, I was trying to decide what happened to me in that Krispy Kreme place. But in reflection of it, it was the environment that they created that made the customer experience such that you had to buy the donuts. It was the natural extension of the operation. I've used that story 1,000-fold. That happened to me back in 2000. It is 2015. I'm still telling that story. And it still resonates with people because they understand that in an environment conducive to customer service, where people are excited about what they do, where there's genuine excitement in the environment, it's extremely easy to deliver that customer service. It's extremely easy for the brand delivery to come through versus an environment that's so regimented, that's so focused on its own internal views that the customer really can't relate to it. The customer never gets involved in it. That's why when you walk into one of our branches, people approach you. They welcome you, the Bank of America. They ask how they can help. And they're genuine in the fact that they want to help you because for them, that's what it's all about. It's about bringing our brand to the customer. The value of the story that is within each of these kind of pieces I share with you today really comes to the applicability of it. Could people relate to buying a donut? Could people relate to growing up and being in a spelling bee? And it also is the personalization of that which makes it real. And that's why I always tell folks in storytelling, look for the real story that's out there, because the real story that's out there will come across in the way that you describe it and relate it versus the one that you have to make fit to whatever point you're trying to make. As I said earlier, I was looking for that operationalized the brand story for years. I had two or three going into it, you know, and I've gone through them. But that Krispy Kreme story really has stuck with me as a proof point of how to operationalize a brand, because it's real, it happened, I relate to it, and the value of that story comes across every time I tell folks. The other thing I'd say about storytelling is, look, humor helps because it makes it memorable for people and it holds their attention. But by the way, so does the dramatics and or the surprise conclusion, like in the spelling story. In the spelling story, the conclusion of that story is what makes that story relevant to people. Oh my gosh, I was with you all the way until you were going to play for a scholarship. I get that now. I get the relevance of it because there's a surprise conclusion that puts it all together. The Krispy Kreme story, when told in a little bit person, I have a lot more fun with it when having a lot more time to tell it. But the audience relates to it. It's humorous. They get it, and they remember it. When I walk through our operating centers, if they have Krispy Kremes, which many of them do, particularly in Texas and in Arizona, they'll hold up the box when I walk through the center, say, hey, Tony, Krispy Kreme, you know, and we laugh, you know. It brings out a camaraderie, but every time they think of that, they're thinking of operationalizing the brand. It gives them a real role model to execute against. And I think it's true that everything else that we talk about in public speaking holds true in storytelling. Know your audience. Brief is always better. Try to stay on point as table stakes. Many times storytellers wander in their story, they lose the audience. It's a matter of staying focused, getting your point across no matter how much fun you're having up there or how much suffering you're doing up there. Get your point across, be brief, know your audience, and look for that story because it's there. So Mark, that's kind of my thoughts around storytelling. I'd love to do some interaction with you and or your team.
Well, let's do that. Let's go ahead and open it up to questions first or comments because I think that's the best move to go with. So anybody have any questions or comments for Tony?
And if anybody's on mute, if you just hit *6, that'll take you off mute, and you hit it again and you'll be back on mute.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Any questions? Well, Tony, I actually have a question while folks are getting off of mute. You know, one of the things that you talked about is, you know, you have some real deal stories, you know, experiences that, and you're looking for them all the time. But I do remember I asked you this question some time ago, and I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I will ask the question, and that is, where do you find the source for some of your stories? And I think I remember you sharing one time that maybe your sister was a teacher or a history teacher or a history buff or.
My sister holds a PhD in history, and more so, she holds a PhD in academic learning in history. So she's literally an encyclopedia, walking encyclopedia. And she's one of the greatest sources for me of any quote that I ever need, or anything that I would want to relate to. That said, though, in growing up with her, she would always relate back to history as a predictor of the future and talk about history, which lands on you in a way that kind of shapes you, particularly as a young kid growing up, that you start to reflect, become more reflective on things that happen and how they influence you as you go forward. So, you know, for me, Mark, I literally just used a quote from Abraham Lincoln a couple of days ago that I got from her. I said, you know, we at Bank of America, you may have read it in the papers, we were one of the only banks in the country to be recognized for a lift of our consent order, which the OCC, our regulator, 5 years ago really gave a consent order that said you'll operate in a certain way mandated by the U.S. government across the entire industry, 25-plus banks. And then recently this week, our order was lifted, and we were only one of three banks to have that consent order lifted, and the remaining consent orders stay in place despite being 4 years in the fix. And I was thinking, geez, you know, I've got to address our organization in a couple of, you know, hours on this. I really need a solid quote on this thing, you know. So I called my source, my sister, and I said, you know, I've got this great accomplishment. I'm addressing these folks. You know, what is it that I could say? Within a nanosecond or two, she thought about it. And she said, well, you know, I'd go back to what Abraham Lincoln once said. She said, Abraham Lincoln said that the best way to predict the future is to write it yourself. And what you did in the last 4 years at Bank of America is you wrote Bank of America's future. What a great quote, and what a great way to relate it to folks. And I opened with that quote in our congratulatory speech to our teams on what they had accomplished. Because in essence, it's exactly point on. We kind of wrote our own future, and here it was in the future, and we're reading it in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, CNBC, you know, et cetera. So it was a great moment to call that out for folks, but it also teaches the lesson of how these daunting tasks ahead of any organization, ahead of any industry, particularly the financial services industry, how they can be worked and succeed in their own jobs by really taking the pen in their hand and writing their own story. So it's that moment I always look for. As I said to you earlier, I go into businesses, I go into retail settings, and I'm always looking for those things that I relate to my own business and what am I seeing and what's the story around them. Whether it's going on vacation, whether it's going shopping, whether it's just being out for the day and people watching, it's amazing to me, and it'll be amazing to you if you try this. In the next week, if you just pick a topic in your mind and you go out and consciously look for that everyday story, I will tell you, you will find it. And you might not find the one that's going to be the story, but it'll be the beginning of finding the story that you can then relate to folks with and make large-scale improvements in your organization by creating a mindset that plays into what you think about, you talk about, and what you talk about, you bring about. I'm a firm believer in that. And what storytelling allows you to do, it allows you to talk about. The think about part and the bring about part are up to you, but the storytelling enables that talking in a way that, as I said earlier, going all the way back to my opening comments, that people are conditioned to accept, learn, and remember.
Awesome. That's great. Great exercise too, to allow us to start to build the library of some of those stories. Anybody else have any questions?
Tony, this is Tom, and I just would like to hear a little bit from you of, you know, you talked about what Bank of America has done in the last 4 years and how the good news just came down. But I know that last August, Bank America had agreed to the largest settlement of any entity with the Department of Justice ever, of $16 billion. And I would think that, you know, the efforts that you're doing is trying to motivate people on this new course. Can you talk some about that, you know, of how that's been and what you've done and how people are rallying in a new way?
Sure, Tom. You know, I think what you have to remember of any financial institution today is that most financial institutions today, the larger scale financial institutions, were born of acquisitions. So what you're seeing in the marketplace, banks used to acquire customers by acquiring other banks for the most part. And when they acquired other banks, they acquire their past liabilities, practices, and are subject to being held accountable for those practices of the past, even though perhaps they didn't participate in the same manner in those practices. But that was the way banks grew in the past. Now, what's interesting about today is that banks now have to grow by outperforming the other bank and getting true market share and getting true customer followership. So there's a big difference. 6 years ago, if you wanted to grow your credit card business, you went out and bought a credit card company. And as such, you had a number to choose from because the idea around card companies, mortgage companies, was let's get a company together, let's really run it up so it's doing really well and it's great market share, and then let's sell it. That was kind of the sub-tier financial services business. And then the larger first tier was banks acquiring these companies. So it was almost a beauty contest of companies that you pick one you'd buy, fit into your culture, fit into your platform, and grow with its customer acquisition base forward. You can't do that anymore. So what all banks, and Bank of America is clearly not alone in it, but what all banks did was through that acquiring and acquisition, they acquired a lot of liabilities. Most notably, I think Bank of America is always associated with the Countrywide liability. We bought Countrywide, who was a large mortgage organization, the largest of its kind, and with that came a certain set of practices and protocols that now, post-financial crisis, have been looked at under a new lens. However, the accountability is with the owner, and that's sort of our past. But the more settlements that we do to put that behind us, the more that we're able to point our folks in looking forward versus remediation and back, the better off all of us, Chase, Wells, Bank of America, SunTrust, PNC, pick your favorite, are going to be. So that settlement for us was a huge lift internally, because what that said to us is, okay, we don't have to now do all of our activities and concentrations on remediation. The way I say it to our folks is we have done the things we needed to do to earn the right to do the things we want to do. And we're just now extremely excited and energized around the fact that going forward, because most of those issues are behind us, going forward, it's really about a head-to-head competition with our counterparts in the marketplace and who can out-operate whom in the marketplace for that customer loyalty, for that customer acknowledgement, and for that purpose of making someone's financial life better realized through your actions. That's why people are excited at Bank of America today. They're excited because they can now fully compete on their own merit, and we could stop thinking about what was, regardless of how what was came to be.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Any other questions? Hey, Tony, if there's no other questions, I do have one last question for you. It's always good to understand, you know, where you're coming from and you know, where you've been. But I always am curious about who are some of the leaders that have inspired you and why?
You know, Mark, it's a funny question. You know, I get that question quite a bit, and I don't think people are always kind of ready for that answer. You know, first of all, let me just say that there are a great amount of leaders in business, and you have to separate out, I think, their business intent from their actual leadership skill if you want to assess a leader. So if I were to think about business, I think about Jack Welch, and you might agree or disagree with Jack's business approach relative to, you know, Six Sigma, be number one in three in every market. If you're not in one of the top three, you exit the market, all these kind of Welch-isms that are around. But when you think about GE today, you think about Jack Welch. And when you think about the rise of that organization, it was Jack Welch who made that organization rise in his leadership and the environment that he created in business. It's admirable to study him and to see what he had done, whether or not you disagree with his approach to day-to-day management. The fact that he had the ability to create the fellowship and the environment of which GE prospered in, boy, that's something that's really, you know, in my mind, I think he's one of the most admirable of leaders. I also think that if you again look at the spectrum of leadership in business, you quickly think about Warren Buffett and all of the, for all of his good and bad, Warren Buffett's a master of decentralization. And if you study him and his ability to give independence to businesses, yet have consistency relative to the thought process of how they invest in and operate, that's pretty impressive as well. And that's kind of the business leadership. But if I had to pick an overall leader, if I had to pick one person to say, this person's a great leader, I would pick Martin Luther King. I am enamored with Martin Luther King as a leader. You know, when you think about what Martin Luther King has accomplished in his time, and you think about what was going on in his time and the breakthrough leadership that required, You just sit there and you say, I just don't know how that man created that set of followership in that period of time where all of those that preceded him, and frankly, I hate to say it, a lot of those that came after him have failed in that same leadership venue. But I will tell you this, that to me was a lesson in leadership that I just don't think that comes along, you know, in that realm, in that big of a leader, but once in a lifetime, and we got to actually witness and see that leadership in play. I think that there's a lot of time when I look at that, and I borrow a lot of his quotes all the time, and you know, one of my favorite quotes of Martin Luther King, I give to my team. And I give it to them during our planning and goal setting time. And I say to them, you know, some of you will fly. Those that can't fly, you'll run. Those that can't run, you'll walk. Those that can't walk will crawl, but we're all going to move forward this year. And that's right from his speech. And, you know, you think about that and you think about that follow. So he gave everybody, in that one little sentence there, he gave everybody a place for success. Yeah, I can't fly, but you know what? I could crawl, so I'm going to be successful. I can't run, but I could walk, so I'm going to be successful. The end statement of every one of those implications is success. I mean, just phenomenal. And to me, someone asked me a long time ago, what is the definition of a leader? They asked me in a town hall. And I'll tell you what, at first it stunned me because I sat up there and thinking, my gosh, you know, I've got about 1,000 people in the audience, from executives to frontline agents, and I have to quickly concatenate a boil down what is a leader. And frankly, it came as fast to me as the challenge itself was put upon me. And that is really this: a leader is someone with followers. And if you measure a leader with followership, you'll get the true essence of the leader. Oftentimes, we cloud that with their political influence or their political ideation or their business practices, et cetera. But take all of that out for a second and just measure the followership. And then handicap that with the difficulty of leading in whatever space they're leading, and you know, you got yourself a great leader.
Thank you, Tony. Hey, listen, I really appreciate, and I know the Storytelling and Organizations Group really appreciate your time and the stories that you've shared, but also your perspective on how we can continue to tell stories in organizations and leverage them for the overall goals and the values of the organization. So thank you again very much for your time and for sharing with us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. I really enjoyed it. And remember, there's a story out there waiting, so please go find it. Thanks,
Thank
Mark.
Thank you. Take care, Tony.
Thanks,
Bye.
Tony.
Okay. So I think we'll go ahead and end the recording part of our session. Tom, you wouldn't mind helping
yes.
us with that? Thank you.
Okay.